Hey, critical thinkers, welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today's episode, we are doing a recap of some of the best moments from all the episodes, or at least most of the episodes we did in 2024. And I've got to tell you, it was a really cool experience going back and editing all these clips from the amazing guests that I've gotten to speak with and share their views with you. Many of the guests have been on the Joe Rogan Experience. Most of the guests have somewhere around 500,000 followers or more. Most of the guests are published authors. Most of the guests are medical doctors. I mean, it was an incredible year for Healthy and Awake Podcast, and it's all thanks to you. The show keeps growing and I keep finding new guests. I have some exciting episodes coming up in the new year. And I think a lot of episodes have moments that were really my favorite. Maybe some people have missed those episodes or they just didn't get to it because they didn't recognize the name. And I'm really excited about this episode so that you can maybe hear some of those people you might have missed. Now, if you do like a clip and you want to dive into the full episode, I've included very clear notes in the show notes of the name, the episode, and the link where you can find that particular show. Now, one more quick thing before we get into the actual clips, there are no ad interruptions. So once we start the clips, you'll just get to listen to all that. But also, as we wrap up 2024 and head into a new year, it's the perfect time to reflect on where we've been and really look ahead and set our sight on where we're going. I mean, think back to some of the New Year's resolutions you might have set for yourself last year and take a moment to reflect on how close you got. You know, I really do see New Year's resolutions as a powerful way to commit to becoming the best version of yourself. You give yourself a goal and somewhere to aim to. And if you take the right actions, you can make it happen. So if one of your goals for 2025 is to take control of your health, I'm a board-certified health and wellness coach, and I'd love to help you get started. I've helped countless people achieve their goals of all kinds, everything from losing weight to running a marathon. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can actually check out my testimonials on mikevera.com, which will take you to my podcast and health coaching business, but you can follow the links there. And the best part is that it's easy to get started because the first session is just $1. So you get to try it out, meet me, get a feel for it. I hear where you're trying to get to and I help you figure out how we can get you there. So I say, why wait? Let's make 2025 the year you take charge of your health and stay healthy and awake. So without further ado, let's get into the clips. And please don't forget to give the show 5 stars if you're listening on Spotify or Apple. And make sure you're subscribed on YouTube. Thank you. Happy New Year. And here we go.
The first thing I would say is, humbly, don't accept anything that is told to you, even from me. Although I think I'm right, obviously, but be skeptical about everything and everyone, but especially our authorities. The people in charge of your health, in charge of the country, do not wake up with your health and well-being in mind. There are a ton of hidden agendas, conflicts of interest, and you must first of all learn to question everything. Why is my doctor saying that? Is this even true? Why, when I look around, are people who didn't do that, why are they doing okay? So learn to keep an open mind. Do not accept advice, especially if it's from one of our three-letter agencies. Then what I would encourage people to do is their own research. I mean, we are living in unprecedented times where you can go online and you can have a world of information at your fingertips. That opportunity didn't exist at any other time in history. And we're very blessed. I mean, I can say in many different areas, I've learned more listening to YouTube videos than I could have in any formal education possible. So learn to find the right sources. Use your own gut instinct. I think most people have a good gut instinct. I find actually that the quote unquote less educated people often have a greater ability to sniff out BS than supposedly more educated people because they're streetwise. Whereas many other people who have gone through education, through the system, end up not very streetwise. So learn to do that and then speak to people, talk to people, ask people what they think. And form your own opinion in the end. but you must not accept advice from authorities, and especially not the mainstream media. The United States mainstream media, my goodness, I mean, have I realized that these people do not have your best interests at heart? They are completely bought and paid for in this country by the pharmaceutical industry, and they are not going to step out of line. They are going to give you one narrative, and that's it. And follow the narrative at your peril. You will be following it to a definite, almost definite life of chronic ill health and probably depression as well and anxiety.
The American Dream 1950s style redefined happiness from the original version of the pursuit of happiness that's embedded in the United States Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And so happiness got redefined as excessive consumerism. Now, nothing wrong, as far as I'm concerned, with enjoying things and adventures and stuff like that. But when we define happiness through excessive consumerism, everything gets derailed. And instead of freedom and personal freedom and social responsibility, the common good in constitution languaging, being the formula for the pursuit of happiness, in the 1950s delusion of the American dream, freedom got replaced with conformity to a specific version of a lifestyle that we were supposed to live. You know, the house with the white picket fence and the 1.8 children, I'm being a little facetious there, and the latest consumer appliances and the vacations and all of this stuff. And common good, social responsibility, got reframed as overwork, because in order to afford the excessive consumerism lifestyle, we had to be convinced to, the breadwinners had to be convinced to work in jobs that they didn't necessarily love, longer and longer hours, to climb a corporate ladder in a company whose values they didn't necessarily like, in order to bring enough money home to support their family in living that 1950s version of the American dream. And it turns out that they, most people couldn't succeed at bringing home enough money, no matter how many hours they worked and no matter how much they climbed the corporate ladder. And that resulted in an explosion in consumer debt by the late 50s and early 60s that had never been seen before because of the invention of credit cards. So this American dream 1950s style installed a delusion of happiness based on excessive consumerism, financial greed, scarcity, and addiction to power and control. And when we use those criteria to define happiness, we're way off base, but that's a prevailing spell.
When we look at medical ethics as they apply to novel products, we have the Office of Human Research Protections, OHRP, who's been very silent, by the way, through the entire process. We have the Declaration of Helsinki, which says that everyone should have free, that is without any pressure or coercion, free, full, fully disclosed, informed consent. That is a principle of the Declaration of Helsinki. It has to be for everything. I saw patients today, and each time we work with them, we do have to provide that. And then, you know, during Nazi Germany, with all the atrocities that happened, remember Haber won the Nobel Prize for the invention of nerve gas. A Nobel Prize became part of the atrocities of Nazi Germany. There's a parallel today with Carrico and Weissman, who won the Nobel Prize for pseudouridination. Maybe we get a chance to get to that. But the point is, in Nuremberg, and if you go to Nuremberg, Germany, I recently went there and I spoke. So I went to Courthouse 600. So I had a chance to review the documents. There were Nazi doctors on trial, and they had about 70 attorneys defending them, and Americans largely conducted the proceedings. But the majority of the doctors. They said, listen, we were just following orders.
Yeah.
So what came out of Nuremberg was the code. And this is the code of ethics as it applies to experiments, because largely what the Nazi doctors said is we're conducting experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And point number one of the Nuremberg code is no one under any condition may receive any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for participating or not participating in research or accepting a novel emergency authorized product. And yet quickly after these rolled out, people started to feel coercion. They were told, listen, you're not going to have a job. You can't go to work. You can't travel. I mean, this became very serious coercion all over the world. There, some parts of the world, they said, listen, you're not going to get your social security check unless you take these. And it wasn't just one time. You know, people took, with one product, the adenoviral product, they took one administration. They thought that was it. And then with the other novel product, the ribodeoxynucleic acid products, they were told, listen, you take a primary series, the first one, and then 2 to 4 weeks later, the next one, and that's it. It's over with. But then within a few months, we said, no, they really don't work. So you have to take one in 6 months and take another one and another one. And if we count it up, if someone's actually following this exactly as the guidance indicates, they would actually be on their 12th administration.
Yeah, that's crazy.
One product that's designed to get any modicum of immunity would take a series of 12. And so, you know, I'm so dumbfounded by this. I did a Twitter poll and I said, does anybody know? At the time I did it, I think we were at 7. I said, does anybody know anybody around them who took 7? And you know what? You know what the answer was? It was about 9% of respondents said, yeah, I know somebody who's at 7. I said, who are these people? They said, you know what? We're Canadian healthcare workers.
Oh, wow.
So there's parts of the world where they have just been one after another. I saw a man in my office, a U.S. government contractor this week. He had taken 5 and at the 5th one, you know, develops raging myopericarditis and it's just ruined. So each one is a Russian roulette.
Yeah, excuse my cough there. I've been sick for the past few days, probably with COVID. And I'll tell you, man, I wish I had some peptides right now. But
well, you know, we're working on Peter McCullough and our team, his team and our team are working on a spike clear using a precision, an 8-target precision peptide that targets the specific, it targets the spike. And it neutralizes the spike, and then it targets the destructive inflammatory targets that are overexpressing damaging tissue. And then it has what we call a clotho frag and a mitochondrial enhancing peptide that actually rebuilds a mitochondrial interface and helps with restoring of the tissue. So, and it's in a base of NAD plus. So we actually have a nice construct going on, which is going to be it's going through IND. So it's a safety study. So it'll be a phase 1 safety and it'll be carried out in the clinic under that IND and IRB. So we're looking forward to that. We're working on finalizing the design here by the end of the week. We've been working on it for a little bit and we've got a real exciting cool combination that we're going to be using.
So you mentioned tissue repair from damage. Would that go as far as something like myocarditis, which as far as I know is irreversible?
Well, yeah, myocarditis, it is in some essence irreversible, but you remember you could have collateral tissue rejuvenation. So like you can actually stimulate surrounding cardiomyocytes as well as surrounding vascular tissue to take up the slack to rebuild areas and create a new vascular supply, a new cellular development. And the interesting about once you neutralize spike, right, you're doing a lot right there to get it out of that tissue. And then you're stopping that inflammasome activity where that inflammasome continually destroys the tissue. So we had a design that we did for a patient recently where he had COVID injection and he had, first of all, he was infected with COVID, I don't know, maybe at least once. And then he had the COVID injection. And then the mRNA, and then he had two boosters, and he was going to go for his third booster, and his wife was telling him, do not do that. All right. So he had the molecular analysis done, and we got to see on the analysis a whole lot of vascular dysregulation and dysfunction, a whole lot of pro-inflammatory elements and signaling in the RNA expression and in the proteome expression. And it was confluent. It was everywhere, right? So we designed a 10-target design to address that vascular dysfunction and endothelial inflammatory response to help, one, drop the inflammation down, nurture the tissue, stabilize it, help with better vascular collateral activity to take the pressure off that central. It was an inoperable brain aneurysm, right? Inoperable, a ticking time bomb. And so we have the design that we did for him, which is going to be administered intranasally. And he would do 2 intranasal applications a week for several, or at least 12 weeks. And we're looking forward to seeing a much better picture on that brain imaging.
Some people have a fear of going under anesthesia and not waking up.
Sure.
So that rarely happens. You have to be going in on your way.
Does happen though.
It can. Yes.
Wow.
It can. And you know, there are certain things that can happen with people that have certain genetic traits, but it's very rare. It's very rare. The other reason, or the other way it would happen, is basically if someone was already dying and then they went into the operating room for something to save their life, and we just didn't get there and do things fast enough.
Yeah.
But it's pretty rare to not get to someone through an anesthetic alive.
And not to go on a tangent here, I'm just curious about which of the, because my understanding is that when someone's under anesthesia, there's usually a combination of different things. I had surgery once. They told me it was ketamine, fentanyl, and all sorts of other fun things. And I was like, wow, okay. So is it maybe genetic incongruency with some of those types of pharmaceuticals?
You mean if people have issues with anesthetics?
Yeah. I mean, I had never even considered before my surgery that there was a chance of me not waking up. I would have definitely processed that a little differently. So I was surprised to hear that.
Well, no, with the things that you mentioned, like in the operating room, it's most of the time it's controlled. So, you know, when we put a breathing tube down, we're managing your breathing. We can manage your breathing. We can manage your circulation. So if there are certain drugs that cause problems with those, that's not really the issue. It's more so there's a couple of kind of genetic traits where there's a specific reaction to either like a volatile anesthetic, which are the gases that keep you asleep. And they can cause something, for example, that's called malignant hyperthermia. So, I mean, malignant's kind of the bad word. And then hyperthermia meaning increases your temperature. But really what it does is, I mean, we don't have to go into detail about this, but it's something that can cause death if it's not caught. But we're trained to pay attention and notice the signs of when that potentially could be happening. And that is something that's familial. So it runs in families if one person has it. So we always ask if there was any problems with any anesthetics in any family members. But again, we have 5 years of training, and it's for the times where there is kind of the shit that hits the fan, right? Yeah. The rest of the time, I mean, in the US, they have nurse anesthetists. We don't have that in Canada, at least not yet. They're trying to push it. But that, I think nurse anesthetists they have 2 years of training, but in Canada we've got, and for physicians, it's 5 years, and it's really for all of the catastrophic things that can potentially happen so that we're prepared to deal with those.
The people who talk about weather or climate on a long-term basis, my perception is it seems like they're often telling us what we should do. And it's the same people who are flying around on jets. They're eating steak while telling us to cut down on steak. They're telling us to eat bugs, get electric cars, all sorts of these things. And it just seems a little bit hypocritical. And so that's
There's enormous hypocrisy among the climate activists, which includes a range of people from climate scientists to people in advocacy groups and politicians, and even some in the private sector who are making money off the deal. So, I mean, all of these people, you know, have huge carbon footprints. Okay. And okay, I just moved houses, but my previous house, I had 28 solar panels. I had 2 Tesla power walls, 2 electric heat pump furnaces, all electric appliances, and an electric vehicle. And I, since 2019, I've only taken a few airplane trips. So my carbon, my personal carbon footprint is minuscule compared to all these, the grand poobahs of the climate movement, who are jet setting, even in their private jets. You know, you have these big UN conferences and, you know, they all arrive in private jets. It's beyond, you know, and Leonardo DiCaprio, which is with his enormous yacht. I mean, it's bigger than my neighborhood. You know, all of this is just enormous hypocrisy. People are just playing this. I don't know what their agenda is. It's about control. It's about careerism. It's about, you know, who knows what drives these people. And it's probably a mix of motives. But if you look at where we're at right now, this is the best time ever to be alive on planet Earth. I mean, we're doing great. The population has grown enormously over the last 50 years, and fewer people are living in poverty. Life expectancy has increased substantially. Agricultural productivity is way up. The number of deaths per capita from extreme weather events is down by 2 orders of magnitude. You know, where's the crisis? You know, and people try to say, oh, you know, blame every extreme weather event on global warming. Well, I mean, you can't, there's no basis for that. And in the U.S., if you look back, the weather was much worse in the 1930s than it's been in the 21st century, much worse. The worst heat waves, the worst droughts, the worst forest fires, even the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes, you know, and the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was significantly lower back then. The temperatures were significantly cooler that back then. There is no simple relationship between carbon dioxide warming and extreme weather events. So, you know, we're just chasing our tails over this nonsense. And there's a lot of propaganda that has gone on just to play into people's fears. And people who, a lot of people don't know what to think. And a lot of people about the issue, and a lot of people ignore the issue. In many ways, my book is targeted at them to try to give them a more rational foundation for thinking about the issue. I don't know if the activist alarmist people will read my book. None of them have reviewed my book, which is sort of, you know, try to trash it. They mostly tried to ignore it because I think it's pretty even-handed and, you know, it's not partisan in any way. But I haven't had any negative reviews. And even on Twitter, the alarm people haven't really been talking about my book. You know, all the reviews have come from economists and engineers and people like that. So I guess they don't know what to make of it, but they still keep calling me a denier. But there's nothing. I tried to make my book as even-handed, presenting both sides of the arguments so people can make up their own mind and talk about uncertainty and risk. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a unique perspective, certainly, but I think it's sort of hard to tear down, which is why people haven't been tearing it down, even though they'll come attack me on Twitter for the tiniest little thing I say.
Hypercar Queen does a few things. In fact, the first study that made me really start using hydroxychloroquine was done under Anthony Fauci in 2005. Where if you go Google it online, you will see chloroquine is a potent inhibitor of SARS-CoV-1. Chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, they inhibit coronaviruses. Number one, it stops replication. It stops uptake of the virus into the cell. It stops replication. And then it's also an ionophore. It opens zinc channels and allows zinc into the cell. And zinc is a very potent antiviral. If you just go Google zinc antiviral, you will see that zinc is very potent for many, many, many viruses. But zinc cannot enter the cell. So you need something that will open zinc channels. Hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, that's part of the way they work too. And then quercetin. When we could not get hydroxychloroquine, remember the late Dr. Z, they use quartz eating. If you go on our website, we have what we call coffee bites that have a vitamin C, D, zinc, and quartz eating. So quartz eating opens zinc channels and allows zinc to go into the cell, and zinc mitigates many viruses, many single-stranded RNA viruses. This study is actually in the NIH, you know, something. So if you go and Google zinc antiviral properties, you will put numerous articles about it, you know, something. So we took zinc in the, you know, because you cannot take too much zinc. If you take too much zinc, it will inhibit copper. It can cause anemia. So we put just the enough quantity of zinc in our COVID vitamins that has vitamin C, zinc, and quercetin. Many people too always get colds and everything in the winter because of low vitamin D. So we added vitamin D in it, you know, something. Of course, vitamin C is always good with membranes and you know, colds and stuff. So hydroxychloroquine is also a very potent anti-inflammatory. Ivermectin has like gazillion. I mean, you cannot even put down the number of things that ivermectin does. From being a dewormer to they have studies that show that ivermectin can help for some kind of cancers. Ivermectin is an amazing medication. Ivermectin was actually declared like one of the gated medications in WHO years ago. Do you know what I'm saying? So ivermectin has been around forever. It's an amazing medication. That little molecule, when we had COVID patients, hydroxychloroquine usually work earlier, but ivermectin will work even in late stages of COVID. There are people that were in the hospitals and family members snuck in ivermectin and crushed it and put it into the tube down their throat, and they're gone.
Yeah, the world is going to change. I mean, I guess that's a stupid answer, but it's going to change in a lot of ways. You know, now, and we wrote about this in session two when we released it. We talk about the Turing test and how that is the inability to tell the difference between AI and human. And now it's past that. And people want to know how sentient it is, how self-aware it is. I think it's a lot more self-aware than people think. And all these things are factors. And it is a huge, you know, I'll just say this, and this is a rule. Everybody can write it down because it'll never change. As long as there is a pecking order, and there will always be a pecking order as long as humans are animals, and we're animals. Believe every bit of that. And as long as that exists, everything is weaponized until something better can be weaponized. Everything. The vehicle, the gasoline engine, a trench, a gun, explosives, it doesn't matter. Everything is weaponized until something better can be weaponized. And right now, the thing that is best weaponized is AI. And when we write about AI, we're not talking about robots. That's the easy stuff. We're talking about AI-driven psychological programming, primarily that's foreign-born. And when you talk about AI-driven psychological programming, you really learn about it. It's like you never want to see another one of these machines. I stay off my phone as much as possible. You know, I mandate myself to stay off of it for 2 hours a day during waking hours for no reason other than I just need to be away from it. Because I tell people this, hey, listen, and everybody in your audience, I already know their answer, but we're going to ask the question. How many times, I'll give you an example. How many times have you been sitting with someone in a closed space? Say it's your spouse. And your spouse says to you, we really need to get some laundry detergent. Say you're in a car. And by the time you get home, you pull in your driveway, you've got an advertisement for laundry detergent on your phone. How do you think that happened? How do you think that happened? Do you think God just sent that down? No, your phone did that on purpose because they are curating information. They're listening. They're turning it into answers for you. Well, if they can do that for products and services, they can also do that with ideology. So anything you're talking about, they're micro-messaging you to counter your message or to alter what you think and feel so you will change your opinion and your perspective on things. This is a fact. This is not science fiction anymore. It's reality. And so until we really come to terms with a lot of these things that we're writing about, which quite honestly, I don't think people will. I don't think they will come to terms with it fast enough. I'm sure, not in my opinion. But I think at some point in time, people will. We're putting these books out there as a reference guide. So when people do finally get to the end of their rope and they're like, okay, this is all bad. What do I do? there's a place to go and to learn exactly what to do, learn exactly how to focus, learn exactly who's doing it, learn exactly why they're doing it, and learn what you can do for yourself and for your family. But right now, everybody's caught up in the soap opera, and they don't realize the soap opera is feeding them exactly what they want to be fed and pulling them in the direction that they don't want to really go. This is reality. But, you know, we got to wait for people to catch up to this reality and to identify it. And I think that will happen. But the more we can start listening to the smart kid in the classroom, not just the cool kid on the playground, the more we can get into the physical domain and be with each other, the better off we are. You know, what happened to potlucks? What happened to block parties? When was the last time you heard anybody get invited to a block party? That used to happen all the time. It doesn't happen anymore because people are on the phones. How about a potluck? When was the last time you got invited to a potluck or you had a potluck? Doesn't happen. I advocate for people to have no phone potlucks. Have a potluck at your house. Somebody leave the phone in the car and just be people. If we can just start doing things like that again, it changes things exponentially.
To have this, you know, healthier life. The problem is, you know, as I say, this all came about. The first discoveries were when they found out that nurses working the night shift had 50% more breast cancer in young nurses than those who didn't work the night shift. That was the first discovery, big studies done that led to the World Health Organization in 2007 to come out that blue light at night was carcinogenic. And now, you know, the National Institutes of Health and various bodies have come out. But lo and behold, all the evidence is there. The science is very solid. But the problem is that the lighting industry is still just purely enamored with cheap brightness, basically, which I call junk light, just like junk food. So you can get it junk, it's cheap, it's easily available, it's bright, it keeps your utility bill low, but it does a huge amount of damage. And I think that's going to be a big issue for those companies. There's still 99%+ of their lights are these junk lights they're selling. The industry really has to pivot. But to do so, you know, people like you and I and all your listeners have to be asking for it, because there are two sides of this. The industry can say, well, we can produce healthy lights, but no one wants to buy them, and they're always a little bit more expensive when something's new. Then if everybody wants to buy the cheapest light, then you don't solve the problem. So it's really a two-sided thing. Industry is now very much aware of this. I have a lot of people reading my book and aware of this in the industry. I pointed out the liability risks of the lighting industry. They're going to get into a big problem, like, you know, what happened to all the companies that made asbestos, you know, the huge bankruptcies that happened because of the liability suits from the cancers there. This is going to happen, and they're aware. But on the other hand, they can't make it happen by themselves if the general public doesn't ask for it. And that's the reason I wrote this book, The Light Doctor, you know, to basically get that message out and make it readable and accessible to everybody, so we can we're creating a movement, essentially, an awareness. The science is done, the technology is solved, but it's got to be adopted.
You know, we've talked a lot on this show about the military-industrial complex, the medical-industrial complex. Never in my life have I considered the light bulb industrial complex. Man, that got me thinking.
Huge industry, $150 billion industry, right? It's huge. And and it's dominated by, you know, the chips. A lot of these LED chips made in Asia, mass produced in Asia. They can make things really cheap. And the problem is, what's cheap isn't good for you right now. That's the sad thing.
I just did a consult with a kid that has a pretty bad vaccine injury. And he asked me a really good question, a 13-year-old kid. And he wanted to know why dermatologists and ophthalmologists were so negative on the sun. And I told him the whole story. And the reason I'm relaying this to you, this study was actually done on humans, but this goes to prove to you how important not only doing it in humans is, but also the light controls. It was the original story of why dermatologists and ophthalmologists are really negative about the sun. It was on retroretinal hyperplasia in kids that had kernicterus and bilirubin problems when they're born, you know, jaundiced babies. And they used isolated UVA and UVB light. They didn't use the other frequencies of the sun. And they made the assumption that that UV light is equivalent to what's in the sun. And it turns out it's not. I mean, anybody looks at the Pink Floyd album cover knows that. And it turns out the antidote for UV light is actually the other six colors in the appropriate amounts that are there. And it turns out if you take a jaundiced baby and put it in the sun with all seven of those things, that's the best way to treat a child. The way we do it now is we put them in blue light, which is actually one of the stupidest things you can do. But guess what? The reason they do it is because those papers that they did on UV light, they believe that the UV leads to, you know, DNA damage and everything else. And all the things that they publish, all the things that they say, you have to go back and look at it. They're done in non-human subjects and they're done with artificial UV light. Well, the light that's behind me now, that's the light that we need to be testing. And we need to be testing humans, not, you know, nocturnal mice and rats. That's the reason why decentralized science has a completely different mindset. Because if you don't have light controls and you don't have species controls, I mean, just so you're clear on this, I put a tweet out probably 2 weeks ago, and it's on my forum, that big scientists all over the world, and I actually shared this with Dr. Alexis Cowan, that they're now finding out that studies that are done on men are not equivalent to of things that are done in women. And we can no longer assume that what's done in a man works in a woman. So I tell people all this in centralized medicine to show them we have this belief that everybody should be on aspirin to thin their blood to reduce their coronary risk. Do you know that the data shows that it has absolutely no effect in women, but it actually has a very marginal effect in men? Do any of the doctors out there tell women that you don't need to be doing this? No, they don't. Not only that, the same studies also show that aspirin, if you do take it, tends to work better at night than in the morning. Does anybody get told that? No, because everybody takes a baby aspirin when? In the morning. It's the stupidest fucking thing ever. But this is the reason why this stuff's important. And these are the things that I plan on running through this decentralized network. For example, I told Sam, many of the old papers, like we have from Ansel Keys and all the diet wars, we will be able to put them through this zero chain or zero knowledge proof system, and we will find out how much bullshit really is in the literature. In other words, I'm taking this to the nth level that I told Huberman, and I'm going to prove Eddie Chang wrong. I'm going to show you how much of what's published in the literature is bullshit with this system. So guess what? I'm not just talking about new science. I'm going after all the sacred cows. I'm leaving nothing unturned.
I think it's interesting because, as I mentioned last time that we spoke, we talked quite a bit about disease X, and it seems like Mpox, bird flu, and still talks of COVID simultaneously, all around the same time that many of these rational theorists, as you put it, predicted would happen around this time of the year. And I know even Bill Gates himself predicted that this was inevitable. So, I mean, it's hard to think that this is a coincidence. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
It does appear to be convergence. Now, Gabby, as well as CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, WHO, World Health Organization, World Economic Forum, Gates, they've all said disease X is H5N1 avian influenza, that is going to be the next major area of concern. So we've been in a slow-moving outbreak since late 2020, early 2021. The current clade, which is 2.3.4.46, our research at McCullough Foundation, Nicholas Hosher, first author, indicates that it's a product of gain-of-function research, serial passage research done out of the USDA Poultry Research Center in Athens, Georgia, assisted by University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine and Erasmus University in the Netherlands. And there, they got the organism to pass from chicken into mallard ducks and then on to mammals, sea mammals, and then, you know, cattle. So the host range was extended, but it's a markedly weaker less pathogenic infection. So in humans, just been some mild pink eye, doesn't transfer very well to humans at all. No large numbers of poultry deaths. We don't see mallard ducks, dying out there at all. I've been looking very carefully every time I see ducks, because it's obvious when the animals get sick in nature, you see it obviously. And so it's very mild. So we've concluded that we don't need to have any mass PCR testing of the chickens. We don't need to cull them. We don't need to kill healthy poultry because we can't eradicate it because the mallard ducks keep spreading it back and forth to the ponds. You can tell that the public health agencies are way behind. So they're not even talking about the spread being the migratory waterfowl. That's how it's spreading all over. They simply are mystified why it pops up in Texas or Michigan or Colorado or Iowa. We certainly don't need inoculation programs for poultry. The Chinese have tried that for decades, and it doesn't work. Actually, it makes more resistant strains, propagates the problem more. And we certainly don't need them for humans. And the current product is the 2021 FDA-approved CSL Sequarius Audens product. And that was, of course, there's not enough cases to actually see if it actually prevents the illness. But there, what they did, Mike, is they tested normal human volunteers just for an antibody response. And there were normal human volunteers who died after taking this, this antigen-based product. So I was shocked that A, it was FDA approved, and number two, that the European Commission agreed to purchase 40 million doses of this. And in Finland, they've already started the human mass campaign. So I've advised farmers no mass testing on the property. Just let the chickens get through it. Let the humans get through it. No inoculation programs at all. No culling. And we've researched this at McCullough Foundation, dilute povidone iodine or Ugas iodine, just very dilute. Eye drops work for the conjunctivitis, homemade in saline. The iodine nasal sprays and adding iodine to gargles works just fine. If I was a worker, I'd probably do that every day when I came home because there's just too much dander, too much exposure to it. And at Wellness Company, we've expanded the contagion kit to include Oseltamivir, which has coverage if applied early, as well as hydroxychloroquine has coverage early. It also includes azithromycin for the rare unanticipated case of a secondary staphylococcal pneumonia, budesonide if needed. Remember, with various forms of influenza, they don't die of the viral illness; they die of the secondary bacterial infection. And so the mortality rate being quoted with H5N1. Is not applicable anymore. These are cases decades old from Southeast Asia where there's a massive exposure, families sleeping with chickens, no hospital care, late initiation of anything, poor nutrition. We've actually never had a human death due to this illness in the United States.
Somebody who is trying to energize themselves and they're going to do maybe some rapid breathing or deep breathing, you can't even say, oh, to energize yourself, that's the exercise. Because for some people, the exercise that's going to energize them is actually to do some deep, maybe fast breathing for a moment. They're going to feel like, whoa, I feel awake. But somebody else is actually going to need to slow down their breath to calm down their system. And that's when all of a sudden they have clarity and feel more relaxed and therefore have more energy. All right. So now, what's the answer? It depends. It is said breath is like you have to breathe to calm down the mind. Without breath work, you cannot regulate the mind. That's what you hear everywhere. So my question is, you've mentioned my breath holding. And yes, I have a U.S. national record. When my face is down in the water and I am obviously not breathing and I am obviously undergoing a form of physiological and therefore neurophysiological stress that everybody knows is very unpleasant and becomes even more and more unbearable as you keep holding your breath. And yet I remain physically mentally and emotionally completely calm when I'm not breathing. I'm not using slow breathing to downregulate my mind. It means the mind that I am cannot rely on and use altering and slowing down its breathing pattern with the outcome of calming itself down. So how does the mind calm itself down or itself down? By calming itself down. No breath needed. What does that say? You may use the tool of breath the same way you may use the tool of music or very slow movement like Tai Chi or massage. Somebody gives you massage. For some people, he's doing crochet or some coloring books and it's going to slow them down. What is common to all of these practices that are quieting the mind? It's slowness. You do something slow that you have to do slowly, you become slow. So if you want to have tranquility, tranquility is a form of slowness. Take your time, slow. Okay. In order to have the experience of that stillness, of that slowness, of that quietness, of that tranquility, of that relaxation, of that trust, of that patience, of that here and now experience. In order to have it, since you cannot download it from the internet, you cannot order it on Amazon, you cannot take a pill, that's questionable. You could maybe take a pill that's going to artificially calm everything down for you so you don't have to do it. You can have it without having to do it. But unless you take the pill, you have to do it. What does that say? It's an action. If you engage in the action, then you can establish the state. To engage in the action, you must have a clear intention about the outcome that you're seeking. And then you establish that outcome. Oh yeah, but I cannot tranquilize myself. Well, that's because you're not skilled then. It's a skill.
But I've noticed for a while, you know, when I post something online, just into the abyss, I'm not talking directly to a person. I'm talking into a camera and I just know people will see it. I watch it the next day and I'm like, you know what? I kind of sound like a jerk. It was aggressive, not assertive. And I don't have that same compassion talking to just a general camera where no one's there as I do with a human being.
Yeah.
And I guess it is something I'm working on, just in how I communicate my messages. But I mean, coaching has helped tremendously with that, just on a general level, because you have to have compassion and it's forced me to practice it. And what, again, when I'm talking to people, it comes to me very easily because it's very natural to be not a jerk to people you're talking to. But I guess not even just for me, but for anyone else who might be having those challenges with trying to be more assertive, reasonably, instead of aggressive. Do you have any advice for those people?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is never to believe, trust, or take direction from the automatic brain, from the fight or flight. So anger is a fight. Okay. That your anger is definitely the fight. You've been one-upped. Okay. You've been disrespected. You've been dis. That's a one-up trigger. That's your automatic animal nature. Okay. Nobody says that the lion eating or attacking the gazelle is a bad lion. That's what a lion does. Okay. Because a lion doesn't have the higher consciousness. We have a higher consciousness. They're acting on their animal nature. Our animal nature is doing the same thing. So in order to kind of calm that, it's something I used to do when my children used to have temper tantrums or whatever. I used to say, Daddy's going to take a time out. Or I used to leave the room. And I used to take some breaths, you know. You know, intentional breaths. Slow it down a little bit. And ask questions. And so that's, you know, listen and ask questions is probably the best thing to do. When we believe, trust, and take direction from the automatic brain that we've been one-upped, and it's so easy on the internet to lose that. And like you said, when you're dealing with someone one-on-one, either in person or like we're doing, you know, one-on-one, we don't want to hurt that person. You know, we don't want to attack that person for two reasons. One, we're protecting ourselves because we don't want to get attacked either, okay, or hurt ourselves. But we also do have that mindful compassion, that mindfulness. So yeah, I think that the best thing to do is never respond right away. So if somebody, and I've made that mistake, believe me, I've made that mistake.
Me too.
Like, I'm not perfect. You know, I, yeah. And it just, nothing good comes from it. So it's, whether it's a response, a comment to somebody who says something nasty, or it's a text or someone, whatever, or an email, always take time, sometimes a day, just to ruminate over it and ask yourself, you know, what's, and that's what I do now. You know, what can I control in my life, right? That's what I'm going to deal with. So many of these issues I have no control over. If everyone would just stick to what they can control, like themselves, okay? I mean, don't try to change somebody else or control someone else. How about your own life, okay? And what about your family? So the things that you can control, your own house, get your own house in order before you start spewing other stuff and responding. So those are the things, you know, take time to look into yourself, your own house, take time before you respond. And when you're taking time, take some intentional breaths, learn how to meditate, you know, and I mean, those are some simple things to start connecting with that higher consciousness.
And in my experience, I would add, figure out if it's even worth responding to in the first place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, artificial intelligence was largely created by Elon Musk through the vehicle or company called OpenAI, and Elon Musk describes OpenAI. Elon Musk describes artificial intelligence as summoning the demon, and that is the same Elon Musk that started OpenAI. OpenAI was started, co-founded by Sam Altman, the same Sam Altman that says that AI will cause universal basic income. Universal basic income. That's Sam Altman, the co-founder of OpenAI, is saying that artificial intelligence will cause universal basic income. Elon Musk says that artificial intelligence will push us to the singularity. Yuval Noah Harari discusses the singularity. For those not familiar with the term, Ray Kurzweil, the lead technologist at Google, refers to the singularity. This idea, that's the moment, the inflection point, the moment when the machines take over and humans no longer have authority. So artificial intelligence is that the fastest path to communism, to quote Elon Musk's ex-girlfriend, Grimes. Artificial intelligence is the fastest path to communism, to quote the ex-girlfriend of Elon Musk. This is Grimes, who he's still very close with. That's Grimes. So all I'm saying is artificial intelligence is the fastest path to communism. It is going to be used to usher in universal basic income, and it will be used to fundamentally transform, and I believe in a not good way, the way that we all live each and every day. I'll tell people this. I'll just be real. I don't like toll roads. I think toll roads are feeding the beast. I don't like paying for toll roads where you pay a fee to ride on a road. I think that's double taxation, triple taxation. I disagree with it. But yet I do drive on the Creek Turnpike virtually every day, and I pay the toll. And so someone says, that's hypocrisy. I go, well, if I didn't pay the toll, then I couldn't navigate from A to B the way I want to. So I disagree with it. But I sort of have to use the technology. Another example, I disagree with the globalist agenda being celebrated by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google. Yet I use Google. I don't want to use Google. And what percentage of the Google technology has been AI before they called it AI? Let's do an example. BlackRock has an artificial intelligence technology they use called Aladdin. And Patrick Bet-David stated that Aladdin is an artificial intelligence technology that's been used since 1999. And BlackRock and Vanguard, those two organizations, they control the vast majority of the stock market, and BlackRock's AI controls BlackRock. So, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, when I'm using my smartphone to navigate down the road using maps, is that AI? Is that not AI? When I'm using a Google search, is that AI? Is that not AI? I believe what they're building, what Elon Musk and Yuval Noah Harari and Jaron Lanier, the inventor of the virtual reality, and Sam Harris and Elon Musk and Sam Altman and Bill Gates, what they're talking about is creating technology that will ultimately lead to the implementation of a digital dictatorship
and a dystopian future that very few can imagine. And so that's what I believe we're pushing towards. And I believe as the more and more we embrace technology, it makes it easier and easier for them to implement this thing called the Great Reset.
Well, I think you make a very strong case for the carnivore diet. But I do still hear a lot of like, well, meat can cause cancer from institutions, or cooking meat can, the advanced glycation end products and the HCAs and TMAO and all these different things. And Dr. Joel Kahn says pesticides can be on the meat, in the meat. And so to what extent is meat potentially harmful?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot to unpack there. So obviously, like 2015, the World Health Organization via something called the IARC, the International Association for Research on Cancer in Lyon, France, declared that red meat was a class 2 carcinogen, processed meat was a class 1 carcinogen, right? So that came out in 2015. That declaration was not unanimous. There's a whole bunch of people on that panel. It's like a 22-person panel, and about a third or 40% of the people were like, no, this is not right. David Clearfield, who's at Indiana University, he's a professor, he said that was the most horrendous experience of his entire academic career, because they just rammed everything through. They ignored all the data that would dispute that finding. 30% of the panelists were vegetarian, vegan, ethical vegans, Seventh-day Adventists. They didn't declare any of those conflicts of interest. So you have that, you know, and of course you look at the funding source. Bill Gates funds the World Health Organization more than anyone else on the planet as an individual. He has obviously financial conflicts of interest with that, so it would benefit him to sort of disparage meat in that way. But I mean, even if you take it at face value and you look at that, they said, well, eating meat versus less meat increases your risk for colorectal cancer by 17% relative risk, right? And so we say, okay, well, relative risk, what does that mean in absolute terms? Well, the likelihood of you developing colorectal cancer, just a general generic person, is around 4%, right? It's not nothing, and 4% is not nothing. But that increasing that by 17% now takes it from 4% to 5%. So you have a 96% chance of not developing colorectal cancer if you don't eat meat, and now you have a 95% of not developing colorectal cancer in that way. So the magnitude of effect is actually quite small, even if you totally take their conclusions at face value. Now, since that time, there have been a number of studies. Washington University back in 2022 basically said, look, this is garbage. This is garbage science basing it on epidemiologic studies. It's just completely ridiculous. Gordon Guyatt, who is the guy, literally the guy who invented the term evidence-based medicine back in 1991, he's up at Masters University in Canada. He basically in 2019 was the lead author on a huge review of red meat called the Nutrirex Consortium, where 14 scientists from around the world basically said, there is no strong evidence to suggest that red meat is causing cancer, heart disease, or any other disease, or impacting mortality. Just keep eating it like you are. And that prompted the Physicians Committee on Responsible Medicine to petition the FTC to retract those studies that were published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And so we've got a lot of pushback from those sort of things. But I mean, even like I said, even if we assume that the World Health Organization's proclamation in 2015 was true, that it slightly increases your risk for colorectal cancer, you think about what else causes colorectal cancer, is associated with colorectal cancer. And you would look at things like obesity clearly increases your risk. Diabetes increases your risk. What really increases your risk is inflammatory bowel disease. That's not like a 17% increase. That's like a 3,000% increased risk factor. So if you have active Crohn's disease, active ulcerative colitis, you have a 3,000-fold, or you know, like a 300, you know, like it's like a 30-fold or a 3,000% increased likelihood of developing this disease. And what happens to people when they go on a carnivore diet? They get leaner. Their diabetes goes away. Their inflammation goes down. Their Crohn's disease goes into remission. So you're saying, well, I've got like 4,000% increase over here with the cumulative risk factors versus 17% here. So it's like, okay, how do I? Anybody that does basic math can say that. They can say, well, if I have $100 in this pot and one penny over here, I'm going to go with $100, right? I mean, it's just, you can look at risk factors that way. So yeah, so there's that sort of matrix you can jump down.
Well, you know, we do food wars. I think we should talk fasting wars. You never hear Sean Baker talk about fasting or Saladino. I mean, the idea that it is good to stop eating, and actually for most experts in the field, like I mentioned, predominantly Volter Longo, PhD, University of Southern California, there are physiologic changes that occur, and they're actually quite healing and beneficial
when you go 3 or more days, not 12 hours, not 16 hours, 3 or more days on water only or a reduced calorie diet, presumably not of Skittles. And after 3 to 5 days, you see major cellular renewal, you know, basically what's called autophagy, and a mild ketosis. So no matter what diet you're doing, maybe 3-4 times a year, stop focusing on your diet and start focusing on therapeutic fasting. I do a program myself 3 or 4 times a year. Many of your listeners will know, called Prolon, P-R-O-L-O-N, from a company in California called El Nutra. And it's a prepackaged box, non-GMO, plant-based. It's all the food, the soups, the olives, the nuts, the drinks are right there. And it's backed by many randomized clinical trials in humans and $35, $40 million of NIH research. So it's not just another little program out there by a TV celebrity. It's serious science. So we talk about eating and eating. And as I say, stop eating 3-4 times a year for about 3 to 5 days, either do it on your own. And some people should talk to their medical team if they're in shape to do a fasting program. But certainly listeners at your age, you know, go grab a box of Prolon and do it a couple times a year. Read the data. I mean, it actually reduces biologic age if you're running some of the biologic aging tests, which is just fascinating. Yeah. And it's pretty, it's easy that it's just open a box and get going. You don't have to create all, if you don't like to make your own food, doing a 5-day Prolon is a joy because it's all there.
It does look really cool. I've heard Dr. Rhonda Patrick echo the same thing specifically with Prolon. I'm about to have Dr. Robert Lufkin on the show, who's talked a lot about intermittent fasting and fasting right in general. So I do think that's definitely worth checking out. Actually, I was listening in on your Instagram live yesterday with the proponents of Prolon.
Yeah, we're doing kind of to help people through it. I'm using Instagram to, I'll do Prolon, other people do Prolon. And it'll be, you know, it's a fun little event to have all their questions answered.
It seemed like from the way you describe that, it seems like a lot of the research out there is packaged to really function as advertising. And you even described the media relationship there too, where these pharmaceutical companies are giving the media a lot of money. And that makes them hesitant to talk about some of these risks because then they might pull the advertising. So I guess to what extent can we trust these pharmaceutical companies, the regulatory agencies, the research in general?
The answer is you can't. Back 30 years ago, when I entered the field, you could. Things have changed, and it's got to the point where you really can't trust anything at all. And among the few people that I can trust is you, if you come along and say to me, I'm on this pill and things have happened. That's almost the only thing I can go by. If I look at the academic literature, if I look at the guidelines and things like that, if I look at what the regulators are doing, in good faith, maybe, okay, maybe the FDA are there thinking that they're doing the right thing. They are trying to, I mean, people's lives may be lost because they don't come clean about the risks, but their thinking is more lives will be lost if we put you all going along for treatment. Okay. So maybe that's the case, but ultimately, it means you can't trust them. It's a bit like in terms of you smoking nicotine, which can be a good drug if we put them into the clinical trials that antidepressants got put into. Nicotine would show less side effects and would show just as great benefits for people who are anxious as the SSRIs do, okay? So there wouldn't be any of the heart attacks or the lung cancers. They wouldn't show up in these trials, okay? Compared to them, SSRIs, compared to nicotine, SSRIs would look worse, okay? Now, we let you manage your own risks on nicotine, but we figured when it got to the point that it looked like, we weren't absolutely sure, but it looked like kind of smoking could cause lung cancer, we begin to put very clear warnings on it, okay, to help you manage those risks. It's still your choice, but you're in the business of managing the risks, okay? Now, when they make nicotine or SSRIs available through me, I have to get a clear message, a bit like, you know, the thing that's on the packet of cigarettes, a very clear message. That's not there. So you may have a good doctor, you may have a person you like, a person who you can talk about all sorts of things to. When it comes to a hazard like this, they're almost as much in the dark as you are, maybe even more in the dark, because they don't want to think they've given you a pill. Well, they don't want to be shown up as being awfully naive. They should be on top of all this, and they aren't. So it's very difficult. Plus, a further thing. A good doctor these days used to be a doctor who listened to you, who looked at you, okay? And we often talk in terms of things like continuity of care. You want to see the same person each time rather than a completely different person who is looking at the computer to find out what the last person said or maybe didn't actually say. But it's really not necessarily having the same person there the whole time. The way health services work, you've got a computer, there's a record there from the last time around. Do you need the same person? We've got the same data. Won't that do? And it's not that. It's much more, it's not having just a nice face who you're interested in football and they'll talk to you about football, okay? It's someone who can learn, who listens to you and learns things about you, okay? And maybe can recognize that there's something different about the way you walked in and things like that. It's that's the key thing. It's rather than just a computer there, it's having a person in a relationship with you who can learn critical things about what's actually going on in you. And that's what we've lost. And yeah, so I think the big thing is there's been a change over 30 years from being able to trust the journals, been able to trust the doctor. I mean, there's always been bad doctors, but roughly speaking, been able to trust the other person that you go to. And it isn't just that. It's if you go a little bit offline, if you go along to anyone else for maybe counseling or health advice, nurse, pharmacist, clinical psychologist, any of these, and they may figure, hey, this dude's on something that's not suiting him, but they will be too scared to mention it. They will figure that it's going to cost them their job if they mention to you that I think this pill isn't suiting you. If you go to a suicide helpline, they can't ask you, did you go on an antidepressant recently? They'll all be told, that's the practice of medicine, and you on a suicide helpline, you're not trained to do that. There's an atmosphere of fear. A lot of people are actually quite scared to talk out about the fact that these pills may not be perfect. And it's a bit like the Catholic Church. If you talked out about at the sacrament and said they aren't perfect, you risk the Inquisition or being excommunicated or things like that. That's religion. But we're dealing with a bunch of pills which can cause problems. If we can't talk about the problems, it's a real issue. And for doctors, a good doctor these days is one who keeps to the guidelines, keeps to the standards of care, which are based on the ghostwritten literature with no access to the clinical trial data. So increasingly, you're at risk from a good doctor, or what gets called a good doctor these days.
One of the things that I like to say that is super simple, but it's something that I think I learned to work with as a morbid gestalt therapist, and that is to simply ask the person, what are you aware of? And in the context of this, let's say the person is saying something really powerful. Okay. Maybe they emoted and said something about how upset they were or how disappointed they were or how frustrating something was, or they just explain something or get something off their chest. And I'll just simply say to the person, so what are you aware of right now? And that works 100 times better than how does that make you feel? When you say, how does that make you feel? A lot of the feel phobic people back up. Okay, well, I'm not supposed to share my feelings. I'm being too vulnerable with that word. What are you aware of right now? That leaves it so open to the person. And what they often tap into is what they're experiencing physically. They say, well, I'm just aware of my jaw clenching. I'm just aware of my stomach being really tight. Or I'm just aware of something really emotional, like I'm just aware of how empty it feels, or whatever it might be. And that simple question, what are you aware of right now? Present moment, right here, right now. It's amazing what that can open.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm going to try it because I've generally avoided that question of how do you feel about that? Or how does that make you feel? Because feelings can be messy. So instead, I usually just go right to like, what do you plan to do with that information? Mm-hmm. And that kind of facilitates things, but it doesn't give them a moment to really reflect on it.
Right. It doesn't give them that moment to get in contact with the feeling. I wrote a blog just recently called Wading into the Lake of Emotions. And it's all about how a coach can work with somebody with feelings, with emotions, and do it safely. And this is a bit of a jihad for me because as a psychologist and as a coach, I've been very keen on coaches need to be able to work with feelings, but stay within their scope of practice. I was actually the chair of the National Board's committee that developed the National Board for Health and Wellness Coaching Code of Ethics and Scope of Practice Statement, and had some wonderful colleagues on that committee that worked on that with me. And the basic idea behind that metaphor, we're wading into the lake of emotions, is it's okay for you and your client to go into the water and get wet, all right? As long as you're standing on solid ground there in the bottom of the lake. But if you've ever waded into the lake, I was going swimming, you know that it gets deeper and deeper. And finally, you get to the point where to take another step forward, you have to start treading water a little bit. You can't really touch the bottom. Okay, do you have an agreement with your client to go swimming? Well, if you're a therapist, you do. If you're not a therapist, you don't. But your client may really want to swim. They really want to go further into that emotion because they're feeling it.
Yeah.
And your job is to nudge them back to where the feet are on that lake bottom, to where that coaching structure is there, to where you can explore feelings. You can talk about these things and talk about how relevant they are to the work that the person is working on in coaching. If you start heading into, well, we're going to resolve all these feelings. Resolution is the job of a therapist. That's deep water stuff.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple. Or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.